Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hello and welcome to episode one of the Competitive Erotic Fan Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Cook, and you've found the internet's number one most trusted source for Muppet boners and horny loners. This episode was recorded live on May 21st, 2013 at the Nerd Melt Showroom here in Los Angeles, where you can catch the show live the third Tuesday of every month at 9 p.m. On this episode, you'll hear round one of the competition, which features comedians Rhea Butcher, Matt Kirshen, Rob Gleason, Alice Wetterland, and Jim Hamilton with a special guest. Round one comics all write erotic fanfiction pieces in advance based upon subjects that they choose. To hear round two, where five more comics read pieces they wrote based upon audience suggestions, download episode two, which features Zach Sherwin, Dan Telfer, James Fritz, John Daly, and Aaron Gibson. Since we've been doing this show, I've kept a list of topics that I'm surprised have not come up yet. And this year, we just passed the one-year anniversary for when the show launched in Seattle. Although next month is the LA anniversary, we'll get to that later. I've been keeping a list of stuff that I'm surprised people haven't written yet. And this month, here's our selection for this month. I can't wait to see what he has planned this year, said Pam directly into the camera. Last year, for our fourth anniversary, Jim tricked Dwight into baking us a cake by telling him it was an obscure German holiday. It would have been a lot better if the cake hadn't been made of raw millet and beet blossom honey. I think Dwight thought it was a horse holiday. It was Friday, and the workers at Dunder Mifflin were all getting antsy for the weekend. 5 o'clock couldn't come any faster for Pam, since today was the fifth anniversary of her wedding to Jim, and she knew he had surprises planned. He was going to pick her up any minute as soon as he got off work at the sports bar down the street, which is as close as he ever got to living his vague dream of working for Athlete in Philadelphia, or moving to Austin like he and Pam talked about in the worthless series finale, because like 90% of people under 40 in America, they always talk about moving to Austin and never do it. That's probably the relatability that made Jim and Pam so likable. Can you believe it's been 5 years since Jim and I got married? It seems like only yesterday Pam gloated to Angela, who was long since divorced from Dwight because their love was utterly unconvincing to them and everyone who ever saw them. Oh, keep it to yourself, princess. I have cats with leukemia who've lasted longer than 5 years, snapped Angela. Who's Jim? Asked Lisa, the new receptionist who replaced Aaron after her suicide. Jim is Pam's husband. He used to work here. He's tall, said Kevin. Oh, the guy who always brings you lunch? I thought he was a delivery driver. He is, said Angela. For now, added Pam too quickly, who had put on 20 pounds since we last saw her and since she realized she had cost Jim his dream job and also since Jim started bringing her lunch every day from Wingdings because it was free and they were broke. What's it like cozying up to someone who smells like a deep fryer every night, Pam? Asked Angela. Probably better than sleeping alone, you aging fucking fag hag, snapped Pam, who had ceased any attempt at polite discourse with Angela about 10 pounds ago. Pam gathered her lunch, 2 dozen garlic buffalo with extra ranch and celery, and retreated to finish alone at her desk, where she stared at the teapot Jim had given her one Christmas. She could never bring herself to use it to make tea because it would have meant removing the bounty of thoughtful little gifts he'd stuffed inside it. The golf pencil, a cassette tape, hot sauce packets. Pam, if you can pull yourself away from the trough for 2 seconds, I need to see you in my office. Coming, she replied to the voice from the other room, which belonged to Mark, a humorless automaton who had transferred from Ithaca to run the Scranton office the day after Dwight's suicide, which was the day after his divorce. Pam sighed heavily, dumped the chicken bones in the trash, and tried not to catch her reflection in any shiny surfaces as she made her way to Mark's office. All she could think about was the little hand hitting the five and Jim taking her away from all this, which is exactly what he did. 5 o'clock came around, and Jim was downstairs as he promised. You're sure prompt today, she said, smiling. I snuck out early, said Jim. I haven't wanted to get out of anywhere so badly since Stanley's funeral. Stanley had opened a vein in a bathtub a day after his retirement. When he realized he had nothing to live for since cheating on both of his wives. Also, his daughter now danced in a Pittsburgh strip club under the name Anemia. She didn't know what it meant. She'd heard it somewhere and thought it sounded pretty, and the irony was lost on her. Black people get anemia a lot. I can't wait to see what you've got planned, cooed Pam. You just wait, Beasley, Jim replied, confused. You mean Halpert, Pam quipped. Don't tell me what the fuck I mean, Jim snapped through gritted teeth. I was just saying, Pam sputtered. Jim just drove. They didn't speak until they got home. Pam went straight to the bedroom to slip into something more comfortable. Sweatpants and an XL men's t-shirt that said Claude Monet and featured a cat dragging its paws across a painting. Lest you forget for 2 seconds that she's a fucking mediocre artist. Pam walked out into the living room where Jim was watching SportsCenter for the 5th time that day. Neither of them spoke, and Jim was snoring by 7:30. Pam got up to retreat, defeated, to the bedroom. She tried not to wake him, but as she strained to free herself from the couch, she farted loudly. Jesus, Beasley. Sorry, maybe if you brought me something other than wings for lunch. Yeah, well, wings are fucking free, muttered Jim, sleepily, as he dozed back off, oblivious to the fact that he was sleeping through the 5th anniversary of their wedding. Pam slipped into bed and, before resigning herself to sleep, rigorously rubbed one out over the thoughts of Roy's meaty, illiterate dick. Plowing her while she bent over the washing machine in her old apartment, his fat thumb plugging her asshole like a pregnant mole burrowing into a rotting plum. Pam came and softly whimpered herself to sleep. And then jolted awake. It was still Friday. It was 1 p.m. She was at her desk. It was all a dream. Pam had dozed off for nearly half an hour following her 24-wing meal, and no one had noticed since she was the least essential member of the sales team. A rush of relief came over her. Jim made her an amazing meal that night. There were candles, wine, Jason Mraz, because they both love Jason Mraz. And just after dessert, Pam looked into Jim's eyes and said, "This was a wonderful surprise." "You haven't even seen the surprise yet, Halpert," he replied. "I'll be right back." Jim exited to the bedroom for what seemed like forever. When he returned, he snuck up behind Pam and presented a small, gift-wrapped box. Without turning around, she squealed with delight. She opened the box to find an antique compact mirror. Confused, she held it up to her face and now saw Jim over her shoulder in full clown makeup. "What the fuck?" Pam exclaimed. "Surprise," said Jim. She turned around, and sure enough, Jim's whole face was painted up in an oddly familiar way. He was wearing a bathrobe. "Yeah, I'm surprised. All right, wait, are you the clown from your 5th birthday party? You loved him, remember?" Jim dropped his robe to reveal the head of his dick was also painted clown nose red. The shaft was white, and his pubes still had Jim's haircut from season 1. "Good Lord," said Pam. "How do you even know about the clown?" "I remember everything, Pam. Now quick, do this shot." He produced 2 shots of clear liquid. Pam could think of nothing she needed more than hard booze right now, so she took it. It was bracing, to say the least. "It's my tears from every night before you left Roy for me," said Jim as she gagged. "Come into the bedroom." "This isn't sexy," Pam protested, as he manhandled her down the hallway. He kissed her madly and undressed her at the same time. Pam decided, like most nights, she may as well just get this over with. Once nude, she got up on all fours on the bed so she wouldn't have to stare at his horrifying visage. Jim tried to enter her, but she was bone dry. "Maybe you should have saved some of those tears." "I think you just need to get in the mood," replied Jim. He picked up the remote to their TV and turned it on. Pam, whose face was only inches from the screen in her position, couldn't believe what she saw. It was them on the TV screen. It was a montage of them fucking in this very room from a wide variety of angles, some of which were clearly handheld shots from a third party. "What the fuck?" she exclaimed. "Shh, here comes the good part," Jim said as he attempted to manually stimulate her slack-jawed gum cuff into something resembling arousal, but to no avail. on the screen, Pam was now faced with a montage of money shots. Specifically, years upon years of Jim coming on her back over and over again, each time turning and mugging directly into the camera. This is fucking horrifying, she shrieked. I thought it was romantic, Jim blurted. He couldn't figure out how she hadn't seen this coming years ago. Wait, hold on, I have one more thing. Before she could protest, Jim threw Pam over his shoulder and carried her down into the basement. She was too shocked to speak and just whimpered softly. Jim set Pam down on the basement floor and with all his might slid aside a heavy workbench to reveal a badly crafted sheet metal door, which he pried open. A horrible stench struck Pam's nostrils and didn't seem to faze Jim. He turned on a work light in the cramped crawl space he had just revealed, and that's when Pam almost fainted. Beyond the dim opening, she could make out what appeared to be the feet and lower legs of at least six corpses stacked like cordwood. What the? It's every one of my ex-girlfriends. Now you're the only woman I've ever slept with. Oh, also, I killed Roy today. Don't open the trunk. We're like virgins all over again, don't you see? Oh, God. You're the Scranton Strangler, Pam exclaimed. Well, technically, yeah. But what about all those other victims? Well, it would have been obvious if only my ex-girlfriends turned up dead. Anyway, happy anniversary, Pam. The horror was too much for her to process, and Pam turned to run, but she slipped on the stairs and hit her head. The next thing she knew, she jolted awake in her office chair. It had all been another dream. But this wasn't her office at all. It was a much bigger and fancier office, and just then there was a knock at her door and a well-dressed man poked his head in. Are you ready to go, President Beasley? And then she jolted awake again, still sprawled naked on the basement stairs because the whole Jim is a murderer thing was real. The end. Thank you. And keep it going for your prepared comics this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Alice Wedderlin, Rob Gleason, Rhea Butcher, Matt Kirshen, and Jim Hamilton. And we're going to start with Alice. So give me just Alice. Sorry to call all of you at once. Keep it going for Alice. She's got somewhere she might need to be. Tell them what you did last time, Alice.
I did the Geico lizard. So, it's a little too hot for most people.
It sounded like Matt Kirshen. You guys will get that later.
I will be doing a Yelp review. Cafe Sutra, 1,503 reviews. 1543 Baldwin Avenue, Arcadia, California. Categories, wine bars, tapas, small plates, Middle Eastern. Steve C., Long Beach, California. This is one of my favorite spots in my new favorite spots in L.A. I just had to put that at the beginning of my review, as a lot of the L.A. foodies will skip over eateries that aren't centrally located in Beverly Hills or West Hollywood, or God forbid, Venice. Wake up, people. It's time you ventured away from your comfort zone and tried something new. This little gem of a cafe is hidden inside a strip mall in the small foothill town of Arcadia. Most of the food is Eastern-inspired small plates. And I know, buzzwords like small plates make some people want to stop reading right there. But believe me, there is definitely more to this place than the limited yet well-priced menu. My buddy Trevor and his girlfriend Serena live in Arcadia, so we decided to try this place after a pretty intense hip-hop Ashtanga yoga class at Little River Yoga nearby. Little River Yoga nearby. See other review. We had an appetite and were pleasantly surprised by the portion sizes, but I'm getting ahead of myself. The first thing you notice when you walk into Cafe Sutra is the vibe. It's very intimate, and all the tables are sort of crammed together with an eclectic style of furniture, but it's laid out in a way where no one feels crowded, just kind of extra friendly. The walls are painted this dark pink color. It sounds gross, but it works. Serena remarked that it looked like the inside of a vagina. We sat down next to a couple that had just ordered a bottle of rosé, and since it looked so refreshing, we ordered some of our own from the really well-curated wine list. Trevor decided to have a beer. But even he tried the rosé and said it was chill. Serena and I sat next to each other on the bench seat that looked like an antique thing, so we could share a delicious plate of papas bravas masala with yogurt sauce. And Trevor started with curry mussels. Here is where I have to comment on the service. The wait staff was friendly and so attentive, and that was surprising considering how attractive they all were. Our waitress, Gemma, was a buxom blonde that was positively poured into her black short shorts and Cafe Sutra tea. Not that I'm complaining. Trevor and I were staring so much, I thought Serena would balk, but she actually seemed enchanted and even asked if she could buy one of the t-shirts. Gemma laughed and joked that since hers was the last one, maybe they should trade shirts. Admittedly, I was hoping they would make good on the joke. But then Gemma brought us our entrees, an absolutely splendid tilapia kebab sandwich, and a Shirazi jicama salad with a side of garlic naan toast points and edamame hummus, which we all shared. It must have smelled wonderful because the couple next to us started sniffing around and asking if they could try some. Normally, I'd be annoyed by this kind of behavior, but they were so cute about it. The girl and the couple seemed like she was making eyes at Trevor, actually. Again, I thought Serena would be upset, but she actually was laughing a lot. I guess it was the wine, which Gemma had been refilling occasionally, but not in an overbearing way. Serena started to get flirtatious with the guy in the couple, feeding him toast points. I was like, hey, those are my toast points. But it was cool because the whole scene was kind of hot. Hey, I'm a guy. Finally, Trevor put a stop to it and started making out with Serena. I was like, here we go. Then the couple next to us started making out too, and I was about to ask for the check, but then Gemma asked if I wanted any dessert. I was astonished. Two couples full on making out in your restaurant during a lunch rush, and she wasn't even fazed. Way cool of her. But I wondered if any other patrons would be grossed out by the PDA. That's when I noticed everyone in the place was either making out with each other or just looking totally relaxed. Talk about refreshing. So cool to find a truly bohemian establishment. Especially in Arcadia. Gemma led me over to the dessert case, saying I had to try the pistachio olive oil cake. And she even gave me a free sample, feeding it to me with her fingertip. Don't worry, they wash their hands and the place is really, really clean. I was sure to look for the big A from the health department in the window before I went in. If all that flirting and Gemma's sexy body wasn't enough to take me to the bone zone, this dessert definitely was. You would think that it would resemble a Tres Leches cake, but the texture graduated from very dense at the top to fluffy at the bottom, which means they must bake it upside down. I was embarrassed about my obvious boner, but Gemma made me feel fine because she started rubbing it through my pants as though it was the most normal thing in the world. I loved this part of the meal. And this is where it got really awesome. If you order dessert, she said, they donate the proceeds to a nearby community garden run by an after-school program. What? Okay. What? So I ordered that and some macaroons that came with some fennel jelly candy. I'm normally not a fan of macaroons, but theirs was absolutely delish. Nice, airy, flaky crunch. Gemma was so touched by my excitement about the dessert and also about her handy she was giving me that she took her shirt off and handed it to me, saying sensually, "For your girlfriend." I was like, she's not my girlfriend, she's Trevor's girlfriend. She must have thought that because we were sitting together on the bench. I wanted to ask if she would get in trouble if she was topless at work, but she said if I didn't tell, she would be okay. Oh, wait, I guess I'm telling now. Anyway, she asked if it would be okay if we made out a little, so I didn't feel left out. I looked back at my friends, and indeed, they were all humping each other in a big pile. I was about to say something to those animals, But Gemma grabbed me and started making out with me against the dessert case. I started to worry that some of the more elaborate desserts would fall over. They had a fragrant orange parfait that looked delicate. But the case was very stable and well-made, so I grabbed Gemma and laid her down across the top. I figured we might as well have sex, since the lunch rush seemed to be ending. And so we did. Gemma was so flexible. She must be a dancer, or at least a regular at Little River Yoga. Again, go check my other review. As she lay on the dessert case, cooing with pleasure, I thrust into her over and over, like our forks into that crisp, herb-rich Shirazi jicama salad from earlier. As I enjoyed the smell of spices wafting from the kitchen, I caressed her braless waitress breasts and began drafting this review. Forgetting I hadn't even seen the check yet, ha ha. Now, as we all know in LA, some servers are attractive and not great at customer service. And if they're good at both, you don't expect them to be good at sex. Gemma was great at everything. I looked up during the action to see some chefs busily at work in the small but organized kitchen, and I swear one of them winked at me. Before long, she climaxed loudly, and so I did too, not wanting to prolong things in case she had other tables to attend to. When I finally did see the bill, I was floored. All that amazing food and wine and service and also fucking for roughly $40 per person. Gemma even gave me her number, which I thought was a nice touch. Overall, I would say this is a great little place to enjoy good food and good company and get fucked. All without breaking the bank. Valet parking at night. 4 stars.
Alice Wetterly, ladies and gentlemen. Giving on for Rob Gleason. Rob Gleason, come to the stage. He collected the fuck out of your suggestions, Rob Gleason. Traditionally, we clap till they get to the mic, but you know what? For this guy, forget about it. Forget about it.
Hey, everybody. I did a show that I became very obsessed with in college that's no longer on the air called CSI Miami. So I hope that you know that show. Okay. CSI medical examiner Dr. Alex Woods had been in the forensics lab since early that morning, lighting a scented candle in a forensic lab was against protocol, but it was late, everyone was gone, and she couldn't take the smell of a decomposing body any longer. The case was pretty typical for CSI Miami. A divorcee ran afoul of her ex-husband's late business partner, whose vested interest in a human trafficking operation was squashed when he learned that a philandering mayoral candidate was taking money from a Mexican street gang who wanted vengeance on a prostitution outfit for the alleged carbon monoxide poisoning of an entire minor league hockey team that may or may not have been hired to make a dirty bomb on behalf of a radicalized blogger who was later revealed to be a talking tire iron. But Dr. Woods still couldn't crack it. Dr. Woods was so tired, she didn't notice it was past midnight. She also didn't notice that strawberry blonde CSI topper Lieutenant Horatio Crane had joined her in the lab. "How's the case coming?" asked Horatio as he perused the body. "Oh, you scared me," replied Alex, before admitting, "I can't quite crack the case." "Did it ever occur to you that the late business partner whose vested interest in a human trafficking operation was squashed when he learned that a philandering mayoral candidate was taking money from a Mexican street gang who wanted vengeance on a prostitution outfit for the alleged carbon monoxide poisoning of an entire minor league hockey team, and may or may not have been hired to make a dirty bomb on behalf of a radicalized blogger who was later revealed to be a talking tire iron, was a cover for local art dealer named Xander Steinberg?" Alex considered for a moment and then replied, "No." Horatio explained, "The body has trace amounts of an oil that can be traced back to an 18th century Parisian supply smith that sold colored paints to a not yet famous local artist by the name of Charles Germain de Saint-Aubin. And do you know, Alex, where Mr. Germain de Saint-Aubin's work is sold?" "Where?" replied Alex, who, as a physician, was completely sick of this kind of belittling bullshit. In Xander Steinberg's Midtown Miami Art Gallery. I think you would have put that together had you not been working so hard. You know, just because it's a crime lab, Horatio said, doesn't mean you can't relax. You do know how to relax, don't you? And with that, Lieutenant Kane shimmied out of his trademark blazer and khakis, along with his underpants and socks. Here, he said, removing his sunglasses, I'll show you. Dr. Woods had never seen Horatio naked, his pale and unimpressive physique now standing before her, his body loosely resembling a fleshy street map of varicose veins. Dr. Woods stripped off her scrubs and almost tripped over them because of exhaustion. You're tired, Horatio observed. Are you burning the midnight oil, or is the midnight oil burning you? He asked as he splashed some of the scented candle's wax onto her naked body. Though he had imagined it many times while masturbating in his take-home squad car, Horatio had never seen a black woman naked. Above her vagina was a dense swath of pubic hair, large yet tasteful, the thickness and size of which reminded Horatio of the fur collar on a brown flight jacket. Dr. Woods propped herself up on the examination table while Horatio began to tongue-fuck her cappuccino-colored lady hat. Dr. Woods let out a yelp as Horatio's bony fingers danced around her pink tinkle spout. I can tell from the uncompromised integrity of your labia majoris that you haven't had many visitors, observed Horatio. Whimpered Dr. Woods. Horatio continued, it also looks like you've never once shaved. Ever. If I had to guess, I'd say you might be a virgin. Horatio was right. Between the stress of private high school, then collegiate field hockey, then Ivy League medical school, then her national forensic boards, and then working for this condescending piece of shit, Dr. Woods had never gotten the chance to have a real relationship. Did you know, Horatio said, that the normal pH of vaginal fluid is between 3.8 and 4.5? From what little I've tasted, I think yours is hovering around 3.2. What does that mean? Whispered Dr. Woods. It means I'm going to fuck you. And with that, Dr. Woods could feel Horatio's rock-hard flesh baton start to push its way into her baby hanger. Very nice, said Horatio as he thrusted his Fiji water bottle-sized erection into and out of Dr. Woods' front butt. Like a blood-filled battering ram. Horatio grew bored of Dr. Woods' flesh fiesta door, so he violently flipped her over and began to massage her paper bag-colored crap flap. You know, Horatio said, the anus has over 100,000 nerve endings, making it, instead of listening to Horatio spew obscure facts like an oversized Asperger's patient, Dr. Woods instead grabbed his paintball gun CO2 tank-sized erection and jammed it into her anus. The fuck continued for at least another 20 minutes. Or some other reasonable amount of time for sex to last that I can't think of because I haven't had sex in a while before they both came. Dr. Woods, tired, sore, and emotionally empty from losing her virginity, flopped down on the examination table next to the cadaver she had been working on. As he put his pants back on, Lieutenant Crane couldn't help but notice the juxtaposition of Dr. Woods and the John Doe. He's not the only one that's dead. That was a pun. That's it. That's the end, you guys. You know. I feel like you were expecting a bigger ending.
Perhaps a punchline. I don't know. Rob Gleason, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Give it up for Mr. Rob Gleason. Paper bag colored crap flap. Keep it going for Rhea Butcher, ladies and gentlemen. Rhea Butcher. All the way to the mic. All the way to the mic. There it is.
Thanks, you guys. Saturday, October 26th, 1985, 8 p.m. A beautiful, black, freshly waxed Toyota 4x4 pulls up to the calm serenity of Lake Arrowhead, California. There's a couple of sleeping bags in the back. Still wearing the poncho, boots, and hat, Marty McFly leans in to give Jennifer Parker a kiss and says, "We made it. We finally made it. Back in good old 1985. It's perfect. Just perfect." Jennifer gives Marty a wink and says, "Thanks for the ride, mister. I feel like I haven't seen you in a week. I'm still a bit groggy from whatever that was that just happened to me." "Let's just put all that stuff in the past," Marty says. "Or in the future." "Or let's just focus on the present. Our future really is what we make. It's not written yet. So let's just enjoy now," Marty says. They kiss passionately, like a couple of teenagers that haven't seen each other in approximately 7 to 8 days. "Let's set up the sleeping bags. I can't wait to stretch out. I feel like I've been sleeping on a porch swing or something," says Jennifer. "Great idea," says Marty. They set up the sleeping bags in the back. It's starting to get dark out up at the lake, and the big date is going really well. Better than Marty had originally planned with his dad's Nova that has presumably been erased from existence. The brand new 4x4 had plenty of room for Marty and Jennifer to park. Laying in the back of the 4x4 and looking perfect, Jennifer turns to Marty and says, "Marty, I've got the hots for you. I think I'm in love with you. I think I want to be with you when I'm old. I want to have, like, 2 kids with you." "Exactly 2 kids. One, a girl, looks a lot like you. And a boy. A boy that, again, looks a lot like you. We can name him Marty. It's such a nice name. I think I'm ready." Marty looks deep into her eyes and says, "I've seen a lot of things, Jennifer. Things and people and places that you just wouldn't believe. But one thing I've learned is that the power of love is a curious thing. It makes one man weep and another man sing. It can change a hawk into a little white dove. More than a feeling. That's the power of love." Marty's got his meat hooks all over Jennifer. He expertly removes her quilted baby blue vest. Jennifer is shaking with excitement. Marty moves on to her white denim button-up. One by one, he unbuttons each button with intensity, building the heat and excitement between them. His fingers dance across her nipples just as he played Johnny B. Goode on Marvin Berry's Gibson ES-345 in 1955, a mere 30 years or 7 to 8 days ago. Jennifer moans with pleasure. This really is the new sound he's been looking for. Marty takes off her Reebok high-top sneakers and slouch socks. He rolls down her floral leggings to expose her trembling Hill Valley. Marty's engine is running. His flux capacitator is fluxing. Take me, you dreamboat, Jennifer yells, unable to wait any longer for his nuclear touch. Just then, a lightning bolt crashes through the hot, steamy night. Wind blows the sleeping bags all over. Another Marty and another Jennifer appear next to Marty and Jennifer. They are in shock. Marty and Jennifer Prime. What are you doing here, me? I mean, Marty? Marty Prime says. Are you kidding me? You think I'd miss this? The big date? This is the night you lose it, Marty B says. This is heavy. When the hell are you from? Says Marty Prime. Oh, about an hour and a half in the future, Marty B says. It's your stamina, Marty. Something's got to be done about your stamina. An hour and a half? That's not bad, Marty Prime says. No, you lasted about 30 seconds. It took us an hour and a half to drive back to Doc's and get the time machine. There is no time machine. It was destroyed by Doc's train time machine, Marty Prime says. Well, when I got back to Doc's, you were already there. Remember the Libyans and how there were two time machines because you took one and then the other one went and then there was some overlap? No. Okay, well then somehow I am here. That's all you need to know. Doc said you shouldn't run into your future self, but he never said anything about deliberately traveling back in time in order to fuck yourself. Another lightning bolt and another Marty gets to the lake. Marty Prime and Marty A say in unison, what the hell are you doing here? Are you kidding me? I wouldn't miss this. I'm from another hour and a half in the future. It's your staminas, Marty's. Something's got to be done about your staminas, the newest Marty says. More lightning bolts and more Martys and Jennifers appear. After about 3 hours, there are now 10 pairs of Martys and Jennifers all in a McFuckfest that crosses universes and tangential timelines. If there is such a thing as a paradox, they're going to go out in style. Martys are fucking Martys, Jennifers are fucking Jennifers, Jennifers fucking Martys, and Martys are fucking Jennifers. There are tons and tons of buttheads. They become a swelling mass of passion, writhing and moaning. Marty B shouts, if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything, twirling a pair of purple Calvin Klein underwear above Marty Prime's head. Marty Prime is about to climax. As Jennifer rides him in a reverse cowgirl, he throws his head back and yells, Doc! Just then, Old Biff from 2015 arrives at the lake. He's been stuck floating around in a wormhole after stealing the time machine in 2015, going back to 1955, and meeting his own self and giving him the gray sports almanac. All of the time traveling, self-sexing Martys and Jennifers in one place have pulled his energy to the lake. He slowly creeps behind some bushes. Well, looky what we have here. This is some kind of peep show. Old Biff makes like a tree and gets rock hard wood. Yeah, that's right. Say hello to your mom for me. The end.
Give me a bunch of ladies and gentlemen. Where's Matt Cushion? Matt, you ready? Keep it going for Matt Cushion.
Thank you, everyone. It's nice of them to put the podium here so that, you know, you only see us from the waist up. So... It took me a while to decide what I was going to do for this thing, because I used to read, but I don't really anymore, and I used to you just stop reading like you used to, and I used to watch a lot of TV shows, and I don't really anymore, so I thought, like today, I basically thought, right, I'm going to pick the last piece of useful, fun, cool, interesting thing I read, and I'm just going to do my thing about that. So I've chosen the Google Maps directions from my house to the venue. You take him in your hands and fix him with a stare. A stare that says, "Help me, I'm lost, and I need you to show me the way." You know he'll find a way. He always finds a way. Sure, his ideas aren't always good. Like that one time he took you into a field and a policeman told you off. And that other time he took you into a dark, blind alleyway in the middle of the night. You were worried, but he was so sure of himself you knew to trust him. You always trust him. Because he learned from that. He learns from everything, even you. He'd been taught by the finest minds willing to travel from Asia to San Francisco, feeding him with their tricks and tips. And as fast as they paid off their substantial student loans and sent money back to their home countries, he gathered skills. Skills he'd use on you to show you where you had to be and what you must do. His cursor winked cheekily. A wink that said, "You know what I want. I want your information. I feed on information. Tell me where you need to go." You tell him, "I'm going to Meltdown Comics." But not the store itself. They have a kind of performance space in the back of it that lacks adequate ventilation and looks like it shouldn't work, but it's actually remarkably good. But you'd barely started saying that, and he jumps in. "You're going to Meltdown Comics, aren't you? It's 7522 Sunset Boulevard. The zip code is 90046. You didn't know that, did you? But I did. I know you better than you know yourself." You gulp and tell him, "Yes, that's where I need to go. Show me. Show me how to get there, avoiding toll roads if necessary." He looks up at you slyly. "It's not that easy. You have to choose. Will it be the 101 on Highland? That's 12 minutes, but in current traffic, maybe 15. Or you could take Cahuenga. It's longer, but may get you there faster. What's it to be? Length or efficiency?" You pick the top option, because there's only a couple of minutes in it anyway. "Take me on the 101 via Highland, and then cutting through La Brea to avoid that traffic light on Hollywood where the Christians and the breakdancers are." That's always a pain. This will be the last thing you get to tell him. From here on, he gives the orders. You get into the car, close the door, and move your keys towards the ignition, feeling around, waiting for that perfect moment when everything is aligned and you can just slide on in. Stutteringly, but confidently, like the way Kramer used to enter a room before the series ended and he went all racist. The engine judders into action and the radio switches on. It's Air Talk on NPR, and Larry Mantle is discussing coal miners with a pundit. But no sooner has his ambiguously gendered voice started than it fades away, replaced with another, firmer voice. A voice that is strict and matronly, and definitely female, even though I'd pick male pronouns for the entire story. But I'm sticking to my guns and I'm not changing it now. Live with it. Head east on Landell Street. And you do. You do because the voice tells you to, and that voice is all you need. And also because you live in a cul-de-sac, and any other direction means driving into the neighbor's house. You ease out onto the main road, tentatively. You don't want to be too hasty. There's a car that always parks on the corner to the left, and it makes it very difficult to see past it. You pull up to the traffic lights. They're red, but he tells you, "Turn right." And you know that means you can still make the maneuver. Turning right on a red light feels like breaking the rules, even though it isn't. The California Driver's Handbook, issued by the DMV, explicitly gives permission. You still feel naughty, but you do it. "Turn right to merge onto the 101, it says. To your right, you see the highway. It's huge and wide. It's got to be one of the biggest roads you've seen, and you're not sure you can handle it. You pause for a second and smile. 101, you think. Like the introductory course in a new subject at college. One where your hand is held, metaphorically of course, and you're led through everything you need to know. How apt that this is the road he's taking you along, step by step. Then the man behind you starts beeping, and you apologize with your hand and drive onto the road. You look to your left and merge onto the freeway, starting off slowly due to the physical limitations of your engine, but gather speed and safely slip into the flow of the traffic. Continue for 3 miles, he says, and then nothing. You know he won't say anything else for a bit because he trusts you to stay on the path. The road plows its way through the Hollywood Hills, slamming into the valleys like an angry river, but one where the water is made of asphalt and the frothy bubbles on top are actually cars. That kind of river. This is too easy, you think. And then a thought strikes you. Let's make this more interesting. You reach up and press the OnStar button attached to your mirror. Let's see if 2 people can tell me what to do, you think. How will I react? What if they disagree? Who will I choose? OnStar, how can I help you? I'd like to go to Meltdown Comics, you say, but not the store at the front. There's a kind of performance space at the back. There is, OnStar says. You hang up in disgust. Take the exit towards Highland Avenue, Google says, and you now know not to doubt him. You're hanging on his every word now, and the instructions come thick and fast, like a 19-year-old on an athletic scholarship. Merge onto Cahuenga Boulevard, then keep right. Soon there's barely a beat at a time of Larry Mantle and his whimsical edutainment before he fades out again and again. There's only one voice you can hear, one voice you want to hear. Turn left, now right, now left again, and a final right, and you do, you have to. You're moving in harmony now. He talks and you move, like one beast, half man, half iPhone, with a free yet useful app. You're getting closer and closer, so near you can almost taste it. He counts you down. 3 minutes, he says in the bottom left-hand corner. Now 2, now 1, and you've reached your destination. Thank you.
Matt Kirshen. Keep it going for Mr. Jim Hamilton, ladies and gentlemen. Jim Hamilton. There he is, Jim Hamilton!
Hello, I'm Jim. That's La Bamba. This story is entitled, "It's Your First Time, Charlie Brown." All right. There's more to come. The alarm went off, and Charlie Brown slowly rolled out of bed. His tailbone still hurt from landing on it the day before. Lucy had once again pulled the football away just prior to Charlie Brown attempting a place kick. Having missed the ball, Charlie Brown flew straight up into the air, came down with a hard thud. What Lucy didn't know is that Charlie Brown willfully participated in her cruel trick, because every time she knelt down to hold the football, Charlie Brown caught a glimpse of her panties. One of these days, Lucy was going to realize that a lady should not hold a football while wearing a sundress. But until that day came, Charlie Brown would continue to put himself through the pain of missing the football. Charlie rifled through his closet looking for something to wear. When nothing was deemed worthy, he grabbed his favorite yellow polo shirt from the laundry basket and put it on. He wore that same yellow shirt with the black zigzag every day, but told the other kids that he had 7 identical shirts. Nobody believed him. Charlie Brown was poor, not pig pen poor, but poor nonetheless. He looked in the mirror and carefully curled his one long hair. He thought if he grew that one hair long enough, then curled it across his forehead, people would think he had more than one hair. People did not think this. Charlie and his friends walked to school together, Charlie Brown, Linus and Lucy Van Pelt, Schroeder, Peppermint Patty, and the black kid. Everybody called the black kid Franklin, but Charlie didn't know if that was his real name or just a racist nickname. The whole gang was sitting in class listening to the teacher drone on and on. Most of the students were daydreaming, while a few were straight up sleeping. Charlie was fantasizing that one day Lucy wouldn't be wearing any panties under her sundress. Charlie knew that Lucy was into the brooding musician type like Schroeder. But Charlie thought that one day he could win her affection with his athletic prowess if she would just hold that football still. And after the ball would clear the crossbar, Charlie would take Lucy into Snoopy's doghouse and make sweet love to her. He was deep in this fantasy when the teacher asked Charlie Brown a question. Charlie Brown did not hear the teacher, and he continued to think about Lucy and that sliver of panty. The teacher noticed an erection under Charlie Brown's little black shorts and incorrectly assumed it was her that he was fantasizing about. She raised her voice. Charlie snapped out of his daze. Yes? Oh, no. Charlie had never received attention before, and he was supposed to go play football with the gang after school. The bell rang, and Charlie Brown sat at his desk while all his classmates walked out the door. After the last student had left, the teacher locked the door, let her hair down, and said, Excuse me? Charlie thought he had misheard. The teacher undid the top two buttons of her blouse as she walked over to Charlie's desk. Then she sat in his lap and said, Charlie blushed. She twirled Charlie's she twirled Charlie Brown's lone hair and said, but of course I trust you. If Charlie Brown was anything, it was being too trustful of women. The teacher had never thought about coming on to a student before, but she was very lonely and found it difficult to meet men her own age, what with her speech impediment and all. The teacher whispered. She grabbed Charlie Brown by the waist of his shorts and dragged him to her desk. She knocked off all the supplies and threw Charlie on top of the desk. The boy was naked before he knew what was happening, and the teacher was on top of him. She was bouncing up and down and barking out orders. She yelled vulgarities like, and Charlie did the best he could to please her, but he didn't know what a lot of those words meant. The teacher demanded, you want me to put my what in your where? But that's where poop comes from. Charlie did as he was told, and the teacher screamed in ecstasy. The teacher's orgasm synced perfectly with Charlie Brown's fourth orgasm. It was the greatest 3 minutes of his life. As Charlie Brown walked out of the school, he muttered to himself, good grief. Good grief indeed. Charlie Brown walked to the park with his head held high and a bounce in his step. When he arrived, his friends were already playing football. He stood at the edge of the park for a minute and watched them and thought, what beautiful, simple creatures. Lucy spotted him from across the park and yelled, yoo-hoo, Charlie Brown, come over and practice your place kicks. Charlie confidently walked over, looked Lucy right in the eye, and said, let's do this. And at that point in the conversation, he would normally have his eyes drift to the ground, but this time, Charlie Brown held eye contact for a full minute after he was done speaking. Lucy couldn't look away, and a chill went up her spine. Charlie Brown then measured out his steps, turned back to Lucy, who was still trying to sort out these new feelings. Then she squatted down and set the football beneath her index finger. Charlie Brown sprinted towards the ball without hesitation, planted his left foot, and took a mighty swing with his right. And for reasons she didn't understand, Lucy did something she had never done before. She did not move the football. Charlie Brown's foot struck the ball with a mighty force, sending the ball sailing high and true through the uprights. After a moment of stunned silence, the whole gang jumped up and started celebrating. Even that weird little bird that always seemed to be around was doing backflips. And while all their friends danced around them in celebration, Lucy Van Pelt grabbed Charlie Brown and gave him a big kiss. And it was at that moment... And it was at that moment that Charlie Brown was reminded of the words of the woman who, less than an hour ago, had taught him to be a man. The end. La Bamba.
Jim Hamilton and La Bamba, ladies and gentlemen. Stay close, fellas. Come back up. All right, let's get everybody back from round one. Rhea Butcher, Matt Kirshen, Rob Gleason, Alice Wetterlund, and Jim Hamilton. One more time, we will vote. Yeah, everybody up, everybody up. So first, I will remind you guys of what everybody read and in what order. So don't clap yet, but then we will vote based on your applause after I remind you of everybody. So we started with Alice. Alice had to go to another show. She was the red-haired lady. We started with Alice Wetterlund with Yelp. Then we had Rob Gleason with CSI Miami. Then Rhea Butcher with Back to the Future. Matt Kirshen with Google Maps. And finally, Jim Hamilton and La Bamba with Charlie Brown. So starting from Alice Wetterlund, Yelp. Rob Gleason, CSI Miami. Rhea Butcher, Back to the Future. Matt Kirshen, Google Maps. Jim Hamilton, Charlie Brown.
Your round one champion, Jim Hamilton. And his buddy La Bamba, ladies and gentlemen. Give it up for everybody you saw in round one. Thank you, guys.
Well, that does it for round one. Go download episode two to hear round two. And for updates on the show, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Brian Cooking. You can also catch competitive erotic fanfiction on the road. Upcoming shows include June 14th at the Just for Laughs Festival in Chicago, June 15th at Union Hall in Brooklyn, June 17th at the Davis Square Theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, and June 18th back at Nerdist for the one-year anniversary show, which is also the first LA Championship edition featuring all past winners. Before I go, I'd like to thank the following people, without whom this podcast and live show would not exist. First and foremost, Baron Vaughn and everybody at Nerdist. Also my friend Mark Palm for the amazing artwork. My recording engineer Katie Levine and my good friend Grady Walker who composed the theme music. See you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.